It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress. We'll talk about the legislature's response to the possibility of American strikes against ISIS in Syria. First, it's been a little over 1 year now since the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs approved the Menominee Tribe's proposed casino in Kenosha. Since then, the proposal has been a political hot potato and a source of tension between the tribes. And in a new twist today, the Potawatomi Tribe, who has been the primary opponent of the casino, is refusing to pay their annual casino revenue payment to the state, which comes out to about $25 million, putting added pressure on Governor Walker as he mulls whether or not to approve this new project. Here with us now to talk about this latest twist is Carrie Spivak. He's a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel who's been covering the Kenosha casino story. Carrie, welcome to Central Time.
How are you doing? Good to be here.
So the Potawatomi have opted not to make their casino revenue payment to the state, which was due in June, and this is a significant piece of money for the state. What gives them the jurisdiction to make that choice?
If you would ask the state, probably they would say nothing. They have the agreement with the state through the compact agreements that they pay, I believe it's 6.5% of their net win, which translates to, it's not public, but we've gotten through sources of $25 to $30 million. And the state believes that they have to pay that money. The Potawatomi believe that their compact agreement gives them certain rights of getting refunds from the state if the state were to approve the Kenosha casino. So they feel that they have the right to withhold payment in anticipation of the state approving the Kenosha deal. But like I said, to the state, they have no right to do so.
Now, your words in their anticipation of the approval of this casino, which means they're withholding money based on an eventuality which hasn't actually happened yet. So do you consider this a preemptive strike meant to not so subtly persuade Governor Walker not to approve the casino?
Exactly. I think you're right on target because, again, the Potawatomi would claim that if they do approve that casino in Kenosha and it has the large negative impact on Potawatomi that the Potawatomi believe it would, then they would be owed more than $100 million in refunds from the state. And, yeah, they're saying, you know, this is our preemptive strike, like you said, because we don't want you to approve it, and we want to make sure if you do approve it that we get our money back that we believe that we have coming to us. The state, of course, disagrees with that, with their interpretation of the compact.
Now, I imagine one of the things going through Governor Walker's head at this moment is, were this to go to trial, which way would it shake down? And do we have any indication about what the answer might be?
If you ask each side, you'd probably get a completely different answer. The matter is in arbitration right now, and both the state and the Potawatomi have to submit final proposals to the arbitration panel, and they will choose one or the other, the state's interpretation of the compact or the Potawatomi. But then it goes to D.C., where the Department of Interior says, yes, this is an agreement we'll approve or we'll disapprove. If they approve it, then that becomes the compact amendment. If they disapprove it, nobody knows what happens. So then we can go to round 15 or 16 or whatever we're in right now.
Now, it's a complex thing here. We're talking about these tribal compacts, and some of which, as I understand it, indicate that if the Potawatomi Casino were to suffer losses based on competition from the new, not yet existing Kenosha Casino, then they would be required to be reimbursed by the state. Is that how it works as you understand it?
Yeah, they would have to be required. They're required to be reimbursed by somebody, either the Menominee/Hard Rock or the state. I believe the Potawatomi want to be reimbursed. If it's reimbursed by the Menominee, they want to have the state's guarantee that that money will really be there. The Menominee and their casino would be managed by the Hard Rock, which is owned by the Seminoles down in Florida. They have said they would reimburse any tribal casino in Wisconsin that can verify they have losses as a result of a Kenosha casino. And they always emphasize the word verify, which throws another curveball into the mix of how do you prove it? You know, what would be the standard of proving here's our loss? And for how long would somebody have to make that payment back to the Potawatomi.
Now, we're talking millions of dollars already that haven't been paid to the state on the projected, we don't know, approval of this Kenosha casino. Is that already having an effect on the state's budget?
The governor suggests, he says, you know, right now they're short 20. Well, he's not saying the 25, but he's saying they're short the money from the Potawatomi, which, like I said, is at least $25 million. So, yes, he's saying there is an impact, and he's saying if he were to approve the Hard Rock Kenosha Casino, that impact can be much greater, that the Potawatomi could seek in excess of $100 million of refunds of prior payments that they made to the state. So, yeah, everybody's gambling some pretty big wagers here.
How much pressure does this put on Governor Walker, this move by the Potawatomi not to pay these state fees right now?
I'd say probably significant, although the governor knows how to return the favor by making it public that they haven't paid. So he's putting pressure right back on them.
And how do you expect this to play out? Right now, as we said, the Kenosha Casino is in limbo. Governor Walker hasn't said it's been about a year. There's been no answer from the governor. So what happens next? Who's got the next chess move?
My, how's it going to play out? I wish I knew that one. I'd make a bet somewhere on it. But yeah, I don't know. It's anybody's guess. Right now, this matter is going to arbitration. The state has reached an agreement with the Ho-Chunk on how they would be reimbursed if they lose business to Kenosha. Although the Ho-Chunk is still, even though they have the agreement, they're still opposed to the casino. So the matter is going to arbitration, and the governor has hired, I believe it's for $1.5 million, a Michigan law firm, which in turn hired some gaming consultants to try to get a real picture at just how profitable would a Menominee Hard Rock Kenosha Casino be? How much business would it actually take from the Potawatomi and from the Ho-Chunk? What it would cost the state? Also, how many jobs it would create? How many jobs it would cost? Kind of that overview, since everybody's been throwing charges and countercharge. He's hired these consultants to come in there and kind of be the referee and say, this is what we think would really happen with this new casino. This is what we think the cost would be. And Governor, here's your scorecard. Here's the pluses. Here's the minus. This is why they elected you. You make the choice, because, as I'm sure you know, the governor has unilateral authority by federal law to either approve the casino or shoot it down.
And meanwhile, this is an election year. Governor Walker's seat is in the running. Is this going to affect the race at all, do you think?
It could. I mean, you probably saw the poll numbers that came out today from Marquette, that it's a very, very tight race. One would have to assume that in Kenosha and Racine, they would be very much pro the casino because of the job issue. The rest of the state, you know, it's gambling's a hot topic. So, yes, it is a political issue. It could have an impact on a campaign, but I don't think anybody really knows exactly how much and how so. Some of the Democrats, especially down in that part of the state, are trying to make it more of an issue by calling on the governor to approve the casino immediately. Mary Burke hasn't really made it a big issue. So, you know, that one's still up in the air. You know, it will be an issue. How big of an issue? I'm really not sure. I don't think anybody is right now.
Now, as we said, it's been a year, more or less, since the proposal was on the table for Governor Walker to consider. Now he's brought in some outside consultants. Is there any kind of moratorium on how long that he can sit on this decision before somebody turns into a pumpkin here?
February 19th. He was the feds approved the casino a year ago, August 23rd. They gave him 1 year to decide. He asked for and has received a six-month extension, which brings you out into February. So he has until mid-February to make a decision up or down. If he were to lose the election, it still would more than likely be his decision. I guess he could not do anything and leave it for Burke if he were to lose. But one would have to think that he'll make the decision one way or the other, whether he wins or loses in November.
And, Carrie, as the weeks go by, what are you going to be watching for with this story?
Boy, that's a tough one. it was supposed to have been kind of quiet, and they, you know, the quiet period abruptly ended yesterday. I expect to see more posturing. I expect to see the Democrats in the Kenosha area to continue trying to pressure the governor into making a decision and to approving it. I expect that the Potawatomi will continue to be opposing it. And the arbitration will be going on, although that will be confidential. So I don't know if I'm expecting or hoping for some leaks out of the arbitration process to see, you know, what recommendation will be sent to the U.S. Department of Interior.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
We've been talking with Carrie Spivak, a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's time for our weekly look at Congress. Congress returns to Washington next week after its month-long August recess, and tension over the president's inclusion of Congress in policy decisions remains high. The Obama administration announced yesterday it will pursue an international climate change accord that wouldn't need to be ratified by Congress, and executive action on immigration is expected this week. The president has also not committed to whether or not he would ask Congress for permission to strike the Islamist group ISIS in Syria. On a different note, yesterday Burger King announced it will acquire Canadian chain Tim Hortons and move its headquarters north in what's known as a tax inversion. Legislators on both sides of the aisle have responded, condemning Burger King and U.S. corporate tax laws. Our weekly commentator on Congress, Paul Singer, is out this week, and Susan Davis, chief congressional reporter at USA Today, is here with us. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So there were a lot of comments yesterday from both the president and legislature about Burger King's plan to acquire Tim Hortons in favor of lower corporate taxes. Can you give us the inside scoop here on how Congress is dealing with the reality of a trademark American brand heading north to Canada?
Well, this is an issue that has really percolated in the past month or so. We saw it earlier this summer when Chicago-based Walgreens for also considered a tax inversion and ultimately changed track. There's agreement in Congress that they don't like this process of American companies going overseas. We've seen about 47 companies over the past 10 years make this decision. What there is not agreement on is how you fix it. I think Democrats more want to take more decisive action in the short term to narrowly address this, what we call tax inversion that these companies are doing. But Republicans say you cannot change the corporate tax code bit by bit, and that the only way to really address this problem is to do a really comprehensive overhaul of the federal tax code, which has gotten very complicated. I don't think there's any disagreement on that. But the prospect of doing that now in September, you know, 8 to 10 weeks before an election is almost inconceivable.
Now, the president himself has had a few words about this, indicating that Burger King is not essentially being patriotic. Are comments like that going to make any difference here?
I don't know if they're going to make any difference from a policy standpoint, but I do think that this is something that, because we are in an election year, and I do think that in some ways I think Democrats see that this may help them make an argument for their side of the tax argument, that the tax code, that businesses are manipulating the tax code to protect their own profits, not to protect American workers, and that they've really tried to hammer this sort of middle-class message, I think, in a lot of ways, Democrats have sought to try and spark a little bit of a populist anger in the electorate. I think they've had, you know, varying degrees of success on that, on issues like the minimum wage, equal pay for women, things that I think resonate on a worker level. I don't know if it's going to be effective, but I think that you hearing it from the president, we've heard it a lot from top Democrats in the Senate. Richard Durbin, who's the number two Democrat in the Senate, this has been a huge issue for him, and he's really tried to draw a lot of attention to it, because I think it's something that average Americans just have a pretty visceral reaction to, is these sort of iconic companies, I think Burger King probably falls into that, that are so closely aligned with American, you know, capitalism heading overseas, people just don't like it. They have a very visceral dislike of that practice.
And so you're talking about here what would be required would be a major overhaul of the tax code. And you've got Democrats on one side and way over on the other side Republicans, and their ideas don't have a lot of overlap. So how likely are we to see any corporate tax reform?
I think at the earliest you'd ever see real effort is next year in 2015. A couple of interesting things. Paul Ryan, who is currently the budget chairman, is very likely going to be the next head of the Ways and Means Committee in the House. And that is the committee that has jurisdiction over the tax code. He has made very clear that he wants to try and pass comprehensive tax reform. I think a lot of what happens and how likely that is what's going to happen in the Senate. If the Senate flips and is taken and Republicans take control, I think you could make a case that there might actually be an ability for a Republican-controlled Congress to reach a deal with Barack Obama on this. In some ways, there's already been common ground. For instance, the president has said in the context of tax reform that he could support a lower corporate tax rate, which is a pretty common accepted view among Republicans. So I think that it is not inconceivable that something could get done, but I think if Congress remains divided, it's much harder for a divided Congress to find agreement on what the tax code should look like than perhaps a unified Congress against a president of the opposing party.
And moving on to our next issue, looking at the president, he's taking quite a bit of action on his own on different fronts. And one of these is climate change. He's working on a new accord that would not require the approval of Congress. How would that work?
You know, I've seen this right now, and I'm very skeptical about how much teeth something like this could have. It does also raise some element of what I think Senate Republicans in particular would say are some constitutional questions about how far can the president go to agree to what appears to be a treaty without having two-thirds of the Senate ratifying it. What we do know is that there is not a two-thirds vote in the Senate right now to ratify any sort of global climate or pollution treaties that we would engage with in other countries. That's just not there. I think, and this is one of those situations where the devil's in the details, I do not know how far the president can go to committing the U.S. to reduce population without either an act of Congress or a treaty ratified by Congress. I think it raises a lot of the separation of powers issues that we've seen already this year in terms of the executive orders that he's issued and of the pushback he's seen there. House Speaker John Boehner is already moving forward with a lawsuit from the House's perspective against the administration on what they say is an overreach of power. But I think it is, from the Democratic standpoint, I think it's, and even from the White House standpoint, he has very much faced an inactive Congress. This Congress that is going to end at the end of this year has been perhaps one of the most, if not the most, unproductive in the post-World War II era. So the president has said time and time again, if Congress is not going to act, I'm going to use every tool in my toolbox to move forward on the policies that I want to see advanced. Now, this is a really curious, and I'm not sure, it's certainly not in his presidency, there's a precedent for it. So I think one, announcing this, that he was going to do this, is part of the message that he sent, that where Congress is inactive, he will act. I just think there is still a lot of unanswered questions about how impactful and how meaningful any action he could take as a standalone measure on that issue.
Well, I think it's being billed as sort of an amendment to an old accord rather than something that's new. Is that approach, do you think, going to give it a little more leverage?
It's possible, but I do think it sort of raises a lot of legal questions. I'm not sure what the president can unilaterally agree to if it comes to things like curbing carbon emissions or certain proposals of what they want to see in it. I seem certain that he'll probably move forward with that if they're saying that's what they're going to do. I can't imagine that he can do this without also provoking a lot of blowback on it and having legal issues raised. I'm sure that the White House believes that they're on solid footing doing this, but in some ways, I think it's perhaps more about message and politics than it is about policy and really trying to solve the question of climate change.
Now, speaking of the president acting alone, another area where he appears to be doing this is immigration. He's got some new executive order on the table about legal immigration. What are we seeing there?
Well, the White House has been sort of dancing around this. They've acknowledged that the president, particularly, again, in the face of inaction from Congress, is going to look and is considering an executive order that would essentially slow the deportation of 6 to 7 million undocumented in the U.S. We have not seen any specifics on this proposal. The White House, the president himself has not acknowledged anything that he's going to do, but White House staff and senior aides have hinted that this is one of the things in the orbit of consideration. If the president does it, if the White House moves forward on that, it will be really fascinating to see the impact it has on the political debate in the closing weeks of the midterm elections. We're about 8 to 10 weeks out from the midterms, and I think that immigration, as of right now, has not really been a defining issue in most of the contested 2014 races. We've seen a little bit in Colorado, certainly in some races in California, but it has not been a real driver of this election as maybe I think a lot of people thought in the beginning of the election cycle. So to take that kind of unilateral action that I think from opponents would describe any action that went that far as something what they would call amnesty, although I think it would face a lot, I would also enjoy a lot of support from Democrats, and particularly in the Hispanic community, who have really been pushing the president to take stronger action to send a much stronger message. What I just don't know is what the reverb effect will be if he does take that dramatic of a step. That said, he could not go that far. It seems like this is still something the White House is looking at. They don't know how far they're going to go, but they have said that if they're going to make an announcement, it's probably going to be within the next couple of weeks.
All right. Susan, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That was Susan Davis, Chief Congressional Reporter at USA Today. We're talking about Wisconsin's same-sex marriage case. A federal appeals court judge was tough on Wisconsin's gay marriage ban during oral arguments in Chicago yesterday, suggesting that the ban was harmful to children of same-sex parents. His comments spoke directly to the lives of plaintiffs in the case, some of whom traveled to Chicago by bus to see their lawsuit through. Sean Johnson reports.
The ACLU's bus ride to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals is no express line. It begins the day in Madison and stops for press conferences in Milwaukee and Racine before slowing to a crawl in rush hour traffic outside of Chicago. Among those riding on the bus are Cammie Young and Karina Wills. They've been together for 13 years. They got married in Minnesota in December, and they welcomed their daughter Olivia to the world just 5 months ago. Olivia is also on the bus, asleep in her car seat. Cammie Young says this trip is historic, and even if Olivia won't remember it, she wants her to be a part of it.
Just the sheer fact that we would bring a five-month-old on a bus like this and a trip like this must tell you how much we really want to be here and how important it is for us to be here.
Cammie Young is considered Olivia's parent in Wisconsin. Karina Wills is not. Will says the state would not even let her put her name on Olivia's birth certificate.
We wanted our daughter to have married parents, and so we got married. But even though we're married, we have a child, I'm not recognized as a legal parent, and that's really hurts.
The ACLU's lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's gay marriage ban is about more than just gay parents and their children. But the next morning during oral arguments, it's the children that Judge William Posner can't stop talking about. A lawsuit against Indiana's gay marriage ban is also before the court. Just a minute into those arguments, Posner interrupted to ask why the state had any interest in making it harder for gay parents to marry.
Wouldn't it be better for these adopted children if their same-sex parents were married?
Posner was just as aggressive with Wisconsin's deputy attorney general, pressing him over and over again to explain the state's reasoning for its gay marriage ban.
What's the rational basis for a legislative choice denying same-sex marriage? We know that these people want to get married. We think, or at least I think, it's good for the kids. So what's the offsetting harm?
After arguments, dozens of reporters from both states scrambled to get quotes to explain what just happened. Wisconsin Family Action's Jelaine Appling is there. Her group was the driving force behind Wisconsin's gay marriage ban.
I think we miss the fundamental reality that every child who was born in forever has both a mother and a father. That's a biological reality that we cannot deny.
Appling's attorney, Mike Dean, doesn't mention Judge Posner by name, but he says today's arguments missed the point.
This is why courts are criticized for legislating.
Karina Wills also takes her turn addressing a row of TV cameras. Wills says Judge Posner's comments struck a nerve.
Brought tears to my eyes. I think he hit the nail on the head.
Wills is standing next to Cammie Young and holding five-month-old daughter Olivia in her arms. She says families like theirs have the same ability to raise children in a loving home as anyone else.
For that to be the first words out of Judge Posner's mouth talking about children, it was amazing. It's really touching and lovely.
Wills and the other plaintiffs are soon on the bus back to Wisconsin. Whatever the court decides, there's a good chance of an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court and maybe another road trip, this one to the nation's capital. From Chicago, Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Back to College Time this week. A PBS NewsHour series is tackling issues related to higher education, and they spent a lot of time on efforts here in Wisconsin to tackle student loan debt. Nationwide, Americans owe over $1 trillion on their student loans, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and a growing percentage of students graduate with debt. Scott Ross joins us now. He's executive director of One Wisconsin Now, and he was featured in the PBS series on Rethinking College. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me today.
How big a problem is student loan debt for those affected and for the economy?
Well, I'm going to give you a couple statistics. You mentioned a little bit about the amounts. Right now, we have 40 million Americans who have $1.2 trillion of student loan debt in the United States. And to give you an idea just how vast it is, student loan debt is the second largest consumer debt in America. The only more consumer debt we have is home ownership, mortgage debt. Student loan debt surpasses credit card debt. It surpasses auto debt. It's also the only personal debt that's actually gone up since the Great Recession. And the debt crisis affects all age demographics. For instance, 30% of the debt is held by people over the age of 50. And we actually had, in America last year, 158,000 Americans have their Social Security payments garnished because of student loan debt. So those are just some of the frightening numbers about how much debt there is out in the United States. Now, here in the state of Wisconsin, we've got over 900,000 people who have student loan debt. And what it's doing is, it is a direct drag on the economy, because we haven't had a crisis like this before. Student loan debt, and I'm going to use the phrase only in air quotes, student loan debt was only $200 billion in the year 2000. So you see how much it has exploded over the last 14 years.
Well, what's happened in those 14 years?
Well, a couple things. One, back in the 1990s and the early 2000s, we saw Wall Street and the big banks successfully lobby Congress to first privatize student loans and allow private markets to get involved as the originators of student loans. But secondly, we saw every single consumer protection afforded a commercial transaction taken away specifically from student loans. So, for instance, student loans, you know, they're not treated like any other loans in America. You can't refinance them like you can a mortgage or, say, a car loan. You can't lose them in bankruptcy. Student loans aren't even subject to state usury laws. And usury is actually something that's referenced in the Bible and not as a good thing. But student loans, you know, because, again, the way Wall Street was able to successfully strip away those consumer protections, usury laws for states don't apply to student loans. So that's one component of it. The second component is we've seen a de-investment in higher education at both the state and federal levels. You know, Pell Grants, for instance, in, you know, 30 years ago, used to cover 114% of the cost of a public university. Now they cover just 40% of tuition. We've seen here in the state of Wisconsin, for instance, back in 1990, the percentage of the state budget that went to higher education was about 9.5%. A generation later, that's down to less than 7.5%. And so we've seen both of those things: privatization, the taking away of consumer rights, and a de-investment in higher education. And so now we have students, unlike, you know, say, 30 years ago, you know, or 40 years ago, you know, my parents could go to college, work over the summer at a minimum wage job, and be able to have enough money to pay their rent, their tuition, and maybe pick up food now and again. Now you can't even, it's not even close to that. You could work a minimum wage job for 40 hours a week, 50 weeks out of the year, and not even be able to pay your tuition for a year at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
And you've got some ideas about how to respond to what you're describing. You have an idea. You want people to get organized to form a voting block. Tell us about how your idea could work.
Well, here's what we think. You know, again, when you're talking about just how many people are affected by this, and again, I want to point out, I don't want this to be, you know, I don't want to come off as some generational warrior, that's for sure. You know, I'm old. I mean, I'm like 45 years old, so I'm a solid Gen Xer, you know. But let me tell you that I think Gen X and the millennials have really been, you know, sold a bill of goods by the older generations when it comes to what's happened to higher education and our student loans. And so we think that we ought to take those 40 million student loan borrowers and organize them into a voting block. You know, we have a lot of discussion about issues like, say, Social Security and Medicare, which are two absolutely critical programs. There are 65 million people who get some form of Social Security in the United States, and there's 47 million people who get some sort of Medicare. And we have 40 million student loan borrowers. So I can't remember an election, a national election, say, that was decided by less than 40 million votes. So we know that both the federal level and it's in, at the state level in states all across the United States, that if we can organize this block into an active, consistent voting block, then we're going to be able to have some real changes made to higher education and to the student loan crisis. Because the problem is that this isn't just a moral issue. This is an economic issue. We did a comprehensive research plan at One Wisconsin Institute, which is our research and education arm, and what we found was if you have a student loan debt, you are twice as likely to rent or live with your parents or someone else than you are to own that piece of the American dream, a home of your own. The same kind of statistics bear out with new car purchasing. You know, young people used to be able to purchase new cars. Now they can't because they've got student loan debt. And we're seeing what used to be, say, a five-year payment after you got out of college become a 20- and 30-year debt sentence just to get a higher education. And we always just sort of ask this question. You know, higher education and technical college training is a key to getting into the middle class. How can we continue to be an economic superpower if the means to become middle class involve you being a participant in the second largest consumer debt in your country?
We're talking right now with Scott Ross, Executive Director of One Wisconsin Now. We're tackling issues of student loan debt just in time for back-to-school season, and you can join the conversation. Are you facing a college debt burden, or were you able to pay it all off, maybe avoid it in the first place? You can call and tell us your story. If you're a parent with kids heading to college, how are you juggling the costs, and does that possible debt load make you rethink college? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation with Scott Ross now, Executive Director of One Wisconsin Now. We're talking about student loan debt, and he says the system needs to change, that too many people are stuck with crippling long-term debt, and that people facing that debt should get involved in the political action to make a change. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Would you join a political effort on this issue? Would you consider voting on this single issue to form a voting bloc? Tell us your story about paying for college, whether you're in debt, when you got out of it, or maybe you're worried about it as you begin the fall semester. 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. And Scott, I want to ask you, is this something that people would gather around? Usually when you talk about voters who rally around a particular issue, it's something like the size of government, it's gun control, it's reproductive rights. Does student loan carry that same kind of weight?
Well, I think that's the thing. I think this is something new to build, you know, because the crisis has only happened over the last, you know, like 8-10 years. And so I think that's what we are in the toddler stage of building this movement. But I think there's a lot of good that's going on. And one of the things I like about what you've asked people to do is to call in and share their stories, because I think that's part of it. You know, when we started talking about this issue about 3.5 years ago, you know, people were ashamed to tell their stories. They thought, you know, because again, it had always been that you go to college, you know, you take out some loans and then you pay them back. But people didn't realize, like, how out of control this situation had gotten. And let's be very clear about the student loan borrowers. They're not asking for a handout. They're not asking for a bailout. They're hardworking, and they've taken on the personal responsibility of financing their higher education. They just want to be treated fairly in a system that's treating them decidedly unfairly. And so I think part of this whole thing has been making sure that people feel like they can talk about debt that they've acquired in a system that's treating them unfairly. And we have a website that has just, You know, if you're really, you know, if you're in too good of a mood and you want to bring yourself down, you can go to trilliondollardebt.com and read some of the terrible stories from all over the country that we've assembled of people sharing their student loan stories. But after you read it, then it's time to get active. And we do want to build a movement based on student loan debt to ensure that these folks continue to participate in elections, right? I mean, if we have 40 million people who care about student loan debt, and no one's talking about them, talking about those issues, they're simply not going to participate in our elections anymore. And I think that would be a huge disservice. Also, we wouldn't be solving the problem, which is to do something about student loan debt. And I think the great news here in the state of Wisconsin is that we do have some real champions on the fight, both at the federal and at the state level. If you watched the PBS show last night, you saw Mark Pocan, you know, the representative from the 2nd Congressional District. And he has a great piece of legislation that would allow you to refinance your student loan like you can a mortgage or a car loan. Senator Tammy Baldwin joined with Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, in authoring a Senate version of a student loan refinancing plan. But here at the state level, you know, there was a bill in the state legislature authored by Corey Mason and Dave Hansen to allow for the first time a state refinancing student loan authority.
This I'm going to jump in here because I want to get to our full phone lines of people who want to share their stories. So let's go first to Jessica in Wind Lake. Hi, Jessica.
I'd just like to share my story. I'm 38 years old. I haven't been in college since 1997. I used to attend El Vernal. I was told by my financial advisor, who was a nun, that no matter what, I had enough money for in financial aid to seek two bachelor's degrees, which I did. One day I was pulled out in December that my financial aid didn't come through. I needed $3,000 or I would lose all of my credits. I went from being a nanny to a stripper overnight to try to go to college, which didn't end up working out. I wasn't able to come up with that much money in such a short amount of time. Since then, I actually became a stay-at-home mom of three kids. I became married, and I had had a very hard time finding a job that pays with having three children at home. My husband's taxes have been garnished. I owed about $10,000 from the beginning. No matter how many years I've paid on my student loan, no matter how many times we've tried to pay them down, it just always seems to stay the same amount or go up. My husband's taxes were garnished 1 year because of this. He wasn't married to me when I was in college. I actually was beat up because of my student loans.
Wow, Jessica, thank you for calling and sharing your experience. And Jessica describing, you know, a runaway train there that she hasn't been able to get a handle on ever since. Is that the kind of story, Scott, that you hear?
Yeah, we absolutely hear stories like that. And, you know, thank you to her for sharing that with us. I know from my own experience, listen, I was a student loan debtor for 26 years. And I remember every single day I was racking up $13.40 in interest every single day. You know, I have a person in our office who is a hard-working individual who makes a good living, who's been paying student loans off for 6 years and owes $7,000 more than when she started. You know, that's the kind of stories that you hear that just, you know, that just break your heart and make you angry. And, you know, student loans, I mean, there's been a story that's been going around the last, like, 2 weeks about a family whose daughter had $100,000 in student loan debt, and she passed away. And because they co-signed it, they are on the hook for that, and it's going to be about $200,000 for them to them to pay it off, because student loans have no statute of limitations. And the crazy thing is, in American jurisprudence, there are four crimes that have no statute of limitations: kidnapping, murder, war crimes, and treason, and we essentially treat student loans the same way now.
I want to ask you about the new legislation that we heard before our caller, Jessica. You talked about a Wisconsin law and a Senate law being proposed to allow people with debt to refinance it, often like a mortgage is the comparison. Is that enough for you? If that were to pass, would this address the needs that you see?
I think it's part of the plan. You know, I think there's a whole lot that has to be done. You know, nobody's asking for all the debt to be wiped out, you know, because even if we did that, we'd still start racking up the debt because college costs have skyrocketed. The investment, you know, in higher education, state and federal levels has dwindled. You know, so we've got to come up with something that's just a little, you know, that we have, our start has to be making things more fairly. And college student loans should be treated like other loans, and that means you should be able to take advantage of market rates and refinance your loans. You know, and that's the, you know, the federal plan that, that Senator Baldwin and Representative Pocan and Representative Kind are also involved in, and that's also like the state student loan refinancing plan, which is called the Higher Ed Lower Debt Bill that Representative Mason and Senator Hansen co-authored last legislative session, that actually had the support and co-authorship of all 54 Democrats in the state legislature, and you couldn't get one Republican to join on that. And that just made no sense to me, you know, because if anything, this was a conservative approach to it. It was a market-based approach to dealing with student loan debt, and because I guess the Democrats proposed it, the Republicans in charge wouldn't do anything about it. Haven't gotten any support from Governor Walker on this. You know, I guess the good news for people who care about student loan debt is that, you know, Mary Burke put that refinancing plan in her jobs package. She's the first gubernatorial candidate in American history to do that. And so, you know, people do have that option of, you know, of supporting a plan like that.
I want to go back to our phone lines. I'll get another one of these stories in. We've got Dave joining us next from Oshkosh. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is something that I can jump on board with right away. I am 26 years old, and I got what I'll call fell victim to one of these online schools, private institutions that I was assured was accredited and the whole nine yards. The person I spoke to even compared it to the likes of Harvard because they've been around since 1894 or something like this. They were out of Utah. I won't use their name. But about a semester, I realized what was going on and that this was really just a scam operation. Some of the teachers, I swear, were just bots operating the classroom. And I left the school. Then I got stuck with all of the debt from it. I had taken out loans and such to pay for it. Well, I've since tried buying a house. I can't even get approved for a personal loan, much less a mortgage now, without a cosigner. And on top of that, the school is saying that I owe them money aside from what I owe the student loans, that they were two separate things. I don't understand that at all, how my student loans weren't paying the school I was going to as I was a student at.
And Dave, I'm sorry, we have to leave it there. We're just about out of time. And Scott, in our last 30 seconds, how would you propose joining people together, people like Dave, who have a story to tell for your new political effort?
Absolutely. Two things. One, go to studentloanvoter.com and sign up to be a student loan voter. And also join the national movement, which is Higher Ed notdebt.com, and get information at both of those. You can sign up at the one site and get information at the other site.
All right, Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
That was Scott Ross, executive director of One Wisconsin Now. He was featured this week in a PBS NewsHour series talking about student loan debt.